Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University. Speaking tonight will be Lila Shetsova, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Also speaking will be Roman Shporluk, Mykhailo Kruchevsky Professor of Ukrainian History at Harvard University. Tonight's discussion is titled The Orange Revolution, Ukraine and Russia in Today's World. We begin with an introduction by Institute Executive Director and tonight's moderator, Irina Grudzinska-Gross.
Welcome. My name is Irina Grudzinska-Gross, and I'm the Director of the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University. Our panel discussion is entitled The Orange Revolution, Ukraine and Russia in Today's World. And as the title indicates, we want to talk about the dramatic changes in Ukraine in the context of her immediate neighborhood, but also to look at the new situation that the Orange Revolution created in Europe and in the United States. We have here two most excellent speakers who will address this topic, Dr. Lila Shevtsova and Professor Roman Shporluk. Lila Shevtsova comes to us from Moscow, via Washington, though. She's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she co-chairs the Russian Domestic Politics and Political Institutions Project. Before joining the Carnegie Endowment, she was deputy director in Moscow Institute of International Economic and Political Studies of the Russian Academy of Sciences. And she was also director of the Center of Political Studies in Moscow. She authored several books and is one of Russia's top political analysts. Our other panelist, Roman Shporluk, is also well known to many here. He's a Mykhailo Kruchevsky Professor of Ukrainian History at Harvard University. His interests include nation formation, nationalism, and Marxism in Ukraine and Russia, and also in Poland. His other interests are historiography and ethnicity in politics in the USSR and its successor states. He published several books of history, and his most recent publication is Russia, Ukraine, and the Breakup of the Soviet Union, a collection of articles written over the past 30 years on the decline and fall of the USSR. He's working now on a history of Ukraine from the late 18th century. Let me start with a few words about this orange ribbon that I'm wearing in my lapel, and this also. And I see some people wearing orange here in the room. I have been given this while I was in Poland over the winter break. Poland was elated at that time with the events in Ukraine. Orange Revolution reminded Poles of solidarity movement. In Poland now there's a kind of a political depression as far as, you know, sense of optimism for the future goes. So to look at people who are optimistic and who raise up and who are really fighting for their lives was something that gave Poles an incredible sense of brotherhood and optimism. I wanted to say, before we start the discussion, I wanted to just give us the very short description of what was happening at that time. That is, I mean, November and December of the last year. First, there was a heated electoral campaign with two visits by Russian President Putin, and with the allegation on the Russian part of the American and Western interference in the election. Then there was a contested presidential election on November 21st, when the Electoral Commission announced that Moscow's favorite candidate, Viktor Yanukovych, had won. Then there was international kind of outcry as the international election monitors gave some proofs of the fact that the election was fraudulent. And the supporters of Western-leaning opposition leader Viktor Yushchenko took to the streets wearing orange, in fact, which is the color of Yushchensk, of our Ukraine party. Then the supporters filled the Kiev's Independence Square, Maidan, refusing to leave in spite of the weather, as you remember, until the Electoral Commission ruling was overturned. And the peaceful protests continued for 6 days, after which Parliament declared the election results invalid. And then there was the runoff election on the 26th of December, in which Viktor Yushchenko was declared the new president, after which, with 52% of votes against 44% for Yanukovych. So the country is really split. And this new situation raises several questions, of which some of which the panelists are going to address. How stable is the situation in Ukraine today? How serious is this divide into people who voted for one candidate and another? What is the future membership of Ukraine in European Union a reality? And how important was the Western influence during these elections? And we are going to have the first speaker, Lilia Shevtsova. Then we are going to have Professor Szpoluk speaking. So please, Lilia, starting with you.
Well, first of all, let me express my gratitude to Irena Gross for hosting this meeting, Elizabeth Hamrian, as always, for terrific logistics and organization. And I'm very excited. I'm very excited to be here for personal reasons. First of all, I am excited looking at this panel. Roman, a Ukrainian, Irena, Polish. I am Russian, although I've been born in Lviv, in Ukraine. So it's a kind of, for me, it's a symbolic panel. We are here together, representatives of three nations, and we are friends. So maybe, well, you know, this kind of symbol, maybe it says a lot about, you know, good perspectives for our three countries, God knows. Well, let me start with my points that I've been thinking over. First of all, of course, I am biased. I am biased because I do belong to Russian liberal democratic ghetto, to minority. That's why I'm looking at Ukraine with interest, with hope, and with enthusiasm. I do hope, you know, for a good development of Ukraine in European direction. But at the same time, I should say that I've got a quote to demonstrate what other people within the Russian political and intellectual establishment are thinking now. So you'll have a different position. But, you know, my view is that Ukraine now is the greatest story. Is the greatest story after Serbia and after Georgia. Well, I would say that a lot of pundits, a lot of politicians in Europe and in the United States, they have written off our post-Soviet and post-communist societies, written off our societies as inherently non-democratic, as passive, as minor, well, to the world development. And Ukrainians, after Georgians, they have stunned nearly everyone. They have stunned and puzzled. They have demonstrated that they can do something, that they can self-organize, and that they have courage, they have self-restraint. And so far, they are demonstrating absolutely wonderful political culture and qualities. So this is the greatest story that is unfolding before our eyes. But of course, every great story has a positive perspective, and every great story has impediments, has possibility of disillusionment, has a lot of problems that this country is facing. So I hope that, although we are biased, we'll also are going to discuss the problems and obstacles and challenges the Ukrainians are facing today. I'm going to describe Ukrainian situation from my side of the boundary, from the Russian point of view, but from the Russian liberal democratic point of view. Okay, several points. Firstly, I do believe that Ukrainians and Ukraine, well, is a kind of a test, is a kind of a test for maturity of the post-Soviet space. It's also the test, not only for Ukrainians, for Poles, but it's a test for Russians, first of all. And this is the test for Europe and the Westerners. Depending on how the events will develop in Ukraine, Russia will be looking, will be watching Ukrainians closely, and depending on how Ukrainians will do it, there will be a kind of impetus for Russia to follow this suit, or maybe for Belarus and Moldova. If Ukrainians screw that, if they collapse, of course, it doesn't bring any hope to Russia as well. So several points. Firstly, I do believe that Ukrainians' Orange Revolution was a new type of revolution. For instance, the revolutions in Eastern Central Europe, in Portugal, Spain, before that, in Poland, in Czech Republic, in Hungary, and even in the Soviet Union in 1991 when the Soviet Union collapsed. These were the revolutions against the totalitarian regime, against the dictatorship. Orange Revolution in Ukraine, as well as the Georgian Revolution, are revolutions against the imitation of democracy, against the collusion of the former Soviet apparatchik and bureaucrats from the Soviet times and crony capitalism. So this is a revolution of a new type. This is a revolution against the hybrid political system, against the bureaucratic authoritarian regimes that have emerged in all post-Soviet states with that or that degree of authoritarianism. So it's a new type of revolution, and this revolution has demonstrated that the system that has emerged in Belarus, in Moldova, in Russia, in Central Asia, and I'm afraid in Armenia, in Azerbaijan, this system is not sustainable. It doesn't respond to the new challenges, and it can collapse any moment. Of course, the first revolution of this type has took place in Georgia. But, you know, a lot of us, even liberals in Russia, have thought that Georgian experience is a kind of, you know, local phenomenon. It's a small country somewhere in the Caucasus. Well, it has nothing of the commonality. It's not a trend. Ukraine, with its absolutely wonderful, peaceful, democratic, and legal revolution that is based, you know, on the edge, to have legality and legitimacy as its base, well, has demonstrated that apparently what's happened in Ukraine has confirmed or can confirm that we are having a trend. And so we are asking ourselves a question: who is next, or what country is next? Secondly, Ukraine, of course, demonstrates that in all post-Soviet states, new independent states, we have a kind of moment of truth coming. And this moment of truth is linked to one event. To the succession of power. Nearly in all countries, the former ruling elites and the former leaders are coming to the moment when they have to go through new elections, just like Vladimir Putin, my president in year 2008, just like the presidents in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, now in Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan. And this is really a moment of truth for the ruling elite and for the former leaders, for the old guards, because they want to have democratic legitimacy. They want to have democratic facade. But at the same time, they want certainty. So it's a kind of, you know, they want to have certain results. And in order to have certain results, of course, they would like to do what Kuchma tried to do in Ukraine. You know, to pressure all political opponents, to raise them, to create political desert, and of course to manipulate and rig the results, the outcomes of the elections. And they, before Ukraine, they thought that they would succeed. Now they don't have this guarantee anymore. Thirdly, Thirdly, as only several points. Of course, we don't need to be naive, and the worst possible thing to be idealistic or, you know, to have romantic ideas about Ukrainians and Ukrainian political elite. Yushchenko, Mr. Yushchenko, the president, of course, he's part and the parcel of the private old ruling elite. Yulia Tymoshenko is also part of the Kuchma environment from the previous time. Well, and they are also responsible for the corrupt and clan capitalism that has emerged in Ukraine. But at the same time, there are some new moments that can force them to acquire and to establish new roles of the game. Sometimes, you know, men are doing history, but sometimes history is doing the political leader. And apparently when you watch Yushchenko now, I had possibility to compare him. Yushchenko, 3-4 years ago, we hosted him several times in Washington at Carnegie, and I looked at him, I tried to remember him at that moment. He was shallow, insignificant, such a boring personality. He was at the moment the head of the central bank. I would have never bet that this guy would be standing on the podium of the Independence Square, never. And then in November, December, I saw him from the distance, you know, at the Maidan near Zalezhnosti at the Independence Square. It was a different personality. So sometimes, you know, the history, the movement, the air, the atmosphere makes a leader, and I'm pretty sure that he feels himself a leader, especially overcoming this dramatic experience, being poisoned, and God knows how many years he would live. Only two brief points, wrapping up. Irena has posed very interesting question. First of all, to what extent we apparently believe in Russia that Ukrainian revolution is Ukrainian event, to what extent it has been fabricated or triggered by the Western powers. I will give you only one quote in order to demonstrate that I am biased, but I also want to give you the impression and the view of other people within the Russian political and intellectual establishment. Don't be scared by this quote, but you have to know other views as well. So this is the view of one of the most influential politicians and ideologues in Russia. And he says, quote, Yushchenko is a prominent reminder for Moscow of Washington's true intentions. The United States will use its extensive networks of agents, stooges, vast finances, and effective technologies on the whole post-Soviet territory, including Russia, on issues where America will want to achieve its specific goals. So you see, there are other views as well of what's happening in Ukraine, and I am afraid that President Putin, well, maybe continue to think along these lines. But at the same time, you know, a Russian president and its and relationship between Russian president and Yushchenko really matter a lot for future Ukrainian-Russian relations. President Putin, who spent a lot of energy, well, a lot of money, well, Americans spent approximately $65 million according to the official sources, during the last 3 years in order to promote democracy in Ukraine. Russia spent, according to our very limited information, $300 million only during summer and fall of last year. So you see, the financial backing was enormous. And, you know, as always with Russia, we have here the law of unintended consequences. The more Moscow and the Kremlin wanted Yanukovych, the contender, to win, the more our crude interference helped Yushchenko. So in the end, Roman, I'm not so sure that Yushchenko would have won without our, you know, interference in the elections. Yeah, as always. You see, we have such a great agreement on our panel. And only final thought. I have so many points here, but I'm looking at Roman. Well, he definitely will answer all these questions. We have a lot of challenges before us. I mean, Russia and Ukraine. First of all, about Russia. You know, it's very difficult for us, for Russia, even for liberals and Democrats. Not me, because my family is still living in Khalysia, in Lviv, so I can have Ukrainian citizenship at some moment, if you take me, guys. But, you know, it's very difficult for the older brother to discover that the younger little brother, whom we have always considered as peasants and, you know, obedient people following our route, that this brother does not want to live with us, that we are not married, that we are not even dating, you know. It's not an easy thing to understand or just to see how Ukrainians, even for us liberals, that they are teaching us a lesson. Teaching us a lesson of self-constraint, of democracy, of vision, of strategy, of courage, courage, courage. That the generation, the younger generation in Ukraine, their students, you know, teaching us older people and our younger generation, you know, how to behave as a normal civil society. It's a difficult thing to swallow, especially when it's unexpected. Who could have expected this type of revolution even in summer last year? So it still perplexes us. We still don't know how to do with this kind of challenge for ourselves. Of course, Ukrainians have a lot of dramatic challenge. Firstly, Yushchenko has somehow to deal with the people, non-orange electorate. 44%, yes, rejected, you know, the Maidan Nezalezhnosti, the Orange Revolution in the East Ukraine, and only 52% supported Yushchenko. So still, at least maybe culturally, maybe somewhat politically, the country is divided. So Yushchenko and the team have to give these people the feeling of belonging, have to co-opt them into the general vision. Secondly, what to do with the oligarchic capitalism, all these clans around. The second problem. Thirdly, economic reform. Fourthly, social reform. Finally, how to maneuver between the West and Europe. And Ukraine definitely wants to be part of Europe. And they are part of Europe. And Russia. Finally, you know, a lot of technical issues. Ukraine for Russians is the very important, the only possible at the moment. Well, Belarus is not that important. Transportation channel for our oil, gas. You know, hundreds of thousands, approximately 2 or 3 million Ukrainians are working in Russia at the moment, so migration. And, you know, Ukrainian steel and so many other trade issues that have to be solved. So we are, you know, on the verge of a very interesting epoch when Russia has to rethink its role in Europe, its role in the former Soviet space. Ukraine is to find a new agenda for itself, and Ukraine apparently has to find a new role, not of cordon sanitaire between Europe and Russia, but of a benevolent zone through which Russia can be also integrated into Europe. So these are the challenges. How both countries will answer or respond to them, we'll see. But definitely Ukrainian, with its new leadership, with new mood, with new mentality, with new generation that participated in the Independence Square, can teach us a very good lesson how to become a normal and democratic country. Thank you.
I now know how good it is to participate in panels with Lilia Shevtsova. If she was not here, most of you would not have come here. So I have a chance to speak to people who otherwise I would not be able to address. I am, of course, very grateful to our host, Professor Gross, for the invitation. And I will allow myself to take up some themes in a slightly different angle, a more historical angle, since I pretend to be a historian. But I think if there is some advantage in having problems, agendas, as were said by our chairman, our person in charge, and the previous speaker. And let me give you a historical outline of the road 2004 in appropriately abridged form. I have organized my talk following the methodological advice given by Benedict Anderson in his book, about which everybody knows the title and makes clever faces when he hears them, Imagined Communities. Some people have actually read that book, and even some have understood it. This is a great book for many reasons, but I am taking up from him one idea, namely, from concluding part, that history is really written up time. And he gives an example. We really, our view of World War I is influenced by our view of World War II. Our view of the Battle of Austerlitz is in some sense a product of our view of the Battle of Sedan. You get the idea. So I would like to make some points about 2004, although Professor Grudzińska-Gross already gave us the basic points we need to know about the Orange Revolution, and then to go back to find what I believe are the roots of that event and the context. So my outline is the following. I will first say a couple of words about the revolution itself, but I will be very brief. Then we'll try to suggest the road to it from 1991 to 2004, and again, it will be brief. Then I will suggest that in order to understand 1991-2004, we need to go back to 1945. And I will give you already a view of what I will say, because I may run out of time, so you should hear my conclusions at the beginning. I will argue that actually in 1945, two fundamental events took place that made it possible for 2004 to occur. The Polish front ended. For over 300 years, Ukrainian national cause was always between two powerful enemies, Poland and Russia. 1945 ended the, you know, there is this famous book, Nothing New in the Western Front. Well, the Western Front for Ukrainians completely changed. Everything became new at the Western Front. The Polish-Ukrainian conflict ended. It took time before it became practical force, but the strategic change. Second, the Soviet bloc was formed. Ukraine was united, the formerly Polish, Czechoslovak, Hungarian, Romanian territories, but Ukraine became a country no longer like Soviet Republic, but also in some very important ways an East European country. And that combination, a new nation formed in consequence of the Second World War, and the geopolitical situation, the Soviet bloc, which began to influence Ukraine and Soviet Union, is part of the prehistory of 2004. Then I will allow myself to make a few comments by going even more into the past, but that again will be short. And then my concluding remark, where I will tie with Professor Shevtsova's points, I will say, all these things which I'm talking about, which I regard as so obviously important and fundamental, 2004 became possible the way it was because the Russian government and the Moscow elite managed not to notice any of this. In other words, Ukrainians were very lucky because Moscow, the Russians, got Ukraine completely wrong. They got its history wrong. They did not think about World War II. They did not think about the impact of Soviet bloc and so on. If I had more time, I would quote my favorite saying by Jadwiga Staniszkis, the great Polish sociologist, who describes how people manage by their own effort to become incapable of learning new things. She calls it wyuczona bezradność, self-taught hopelessness. And I feel that to understand Moscow politics in the year 2004, we have a perfect case where they, very intelligent people, manage not to learn by their deliberate effort, addiction to their preconceptions of care, not to notice all those things we are talking about. So let's go over and see what it is that they manage not to learn. First of all, they got it completely wrong about the history of Ukraine since 1991. I think the dominant view in Moscow was that Ukrainians will keep being number two behind Russia. The strategic assumption of the year 1991, shared also by Western experts, was that Ukrainians will be either following the Russians or even lagging behind the Russians. But Russia will lead the post-Soviet space toward democracy and will lead toward market, and Ukrainians will at best be sort of slow learners or in general will not do very well at all. In fact, that view was also shared by many people in the West because they assumed that Ukraine is in fact incapable of surviving as a state, and they were predicting that Ukraine will break up. In my collection of things, handouts for my students, I have that front page headline from 1994 in which it says the CIA predicts violence, civil war between East and West Ukraine, religious conflict, breakup of the country. That was, of course, since Russians followed at that time what the Americans told them, they obviously believed that if CIA says so, it must be true. Okay, but what people did not notice or did not connect was, one, that Russia's road to democracy, shall we say, was not a superhighway. There were some problems. We know about the 1993 conflict between the parliament and the president. We know about the Chechen War. We know about sort of not entirely democratic elections in various years in the 90s. And even though Ukraine seemed to be following the same pattern, there were important differences. And those important differences included contested presidential elections. Ukraine in 1994 actually voted a president out of the office, never mind why and so on. He lost, president lost, resigned, and there was a ceremony at which peaceful transfer of insignia of power of one president to another. In the next presidential election in 1999, the incumbent won, but there was a very real, serious contest. Moreover, parliament always remained a real political force to the very end, to the election of 2002. The current parliament is the one elected in 2002. Opposition did very well in it. There were always abuses, but it was still not a replay of Russian story. Moreover, something which people even more did not notice, both in Russia and very much in the West, although I always should repeat, there were always exceptions. Some of those exceptions are sitting in this room. But I'm talking about the dominant policy-making people. They did not notice that the stereotypes, Catholic, nationalist, Ukrainian-speaking West, Orthodox, Russian-speaking East, are out of date. First of all, Ukraine has three Orthodox churches. And you know, religious pluralism, perhaps it's not good for the salvation of the souls. I don't know which of these three Orthodox churches actually admit you to heaven more safely than the other two. But politically, it's good for a country not to have one national religion. Moreover, the Catholic West is not limited to the West. And what is extremely important, Ukrainian nationalism, contrary to one of the most pervasive myths, was never based, defined by the language. I know it is something which you would have to invite me again to give a lecture to explain it, but I think it is a cliché, it's a stereotype, but which is not really true. Some of the greatest Ukrainian nationalists of the 19th and 20th century were ethnic Russians, when they were sometimes not ethnic Poles. In other words, the myth, Ukrainian national myth, in the sense in which scholars are now using it, in other words, I don't mean anything bad, Ukrainian national myth was defining Ukraine, separating from Russia, by the allegation, we are the kind of people who don't believe in the great Tsar. We believe in Rada, in council, in thinking it over, working together, and we don't expect one savior leader to carry us to better times. And that myth had certain historical, of course, quotations and so on, but that was the point and not the language. Now, let me give you one more element to that myth, even though I probably am running out of time, but I will speed up. The Ukrainian national myth places traditions of Ukrainian liberty in the Cossack historical legacy on the Dnieper. But people never ask themselves, who comment on Ukraine, why is it that the Ukrainian nationalists who are Catholic, why are they so fond of the Ukrainian Cossack myth when Cossacks, as we know, were not particularly friends of Poles, Jews, and especially hated Ukrainian Catholics because they were traitors from the Orthodox. So when you think about Ukrainian myth, while Lviv likes Kiev and so on, because in that Ukrainian national mythology in the 19th century, a synthesis was worked out precisely of this kind. And that synthesis worked both against Russia, Tsarist Russia, because, you know, Russians liked the Tsar, and against Poland, because Cossacks fought against the Poles. So Ukrainian Catholics united themselves with Ukrainian Orthodox against Catholic Poles and Orthodox Russians. You see now, Ukrainian history is a little bit more complicated than people think. Okay, so what I want to say, the civil society which emerged in Ukraine during this period allowed for possibility of various religions, various traditions, various denominations, and most importantly here, a point which I am sure will emerge in our discussion later, the new Ukrainian generation, which grew up, after all, the students of 2004 were kids 15 years ago, or at best 10-year-olds, and certainly were not yet born, many of them, when Gorbachev came to power. These people already grew up in that new Ukraine, in which real NGOs existed, in which religious pluralism existed, in which the Orthodox Church was split, which means you could be non-Orthodox and also be Ukrainian, and all the rest. Okay, let me quickly move then to the next one more step back. 45 and later. I already mentioned it, so I will only summarize it. Second World War ended, as you know, in an extremely bloody inter-ethnic encounter between Poles and Ukrainians. Beneath the Soviet-German War, beneath the great powers, there was a brutal, savage ethnic war in which lots and lots of Poles perished, and the borders changed and all the rest. But something extraordinary happened. The Polish, the most progressive, the most enlightened Polish leaders first in exile, later, several decades later in Poland, said, we have to end that historic conflict. We have to accept that West Ukraine, Lviv, will not be Polish ever again. And our goal is to support Ukrainian desire for independence, because after all, Ukrainians, if they become free, we are more likely to be free. You remember what I said about the Soviet bloc. After all, we are fellow prisoners in the same camp. Therefore, we have a solidarity both for historic reasons and also because together we are against the Soviet bloc. So from my point of view, if I may say so, and perhaps I, you know, panelists are supposed to disagree about something, so I have to think up of some reasons to disagree with Professor Shevtsova. So I've thought up one reason. While I am flattered by her idea that Ukrainians are number two after Georgians, remember, Ukrainians always have to be number two after somebody. They never think up anything themselves. I feel that the Ukrainian revolution actually can be seen, if you have to copy someone, an imitation of the Polish revolution, of the Czechoslovak, of German, indeed go back to even 56, because while communist countries, you know, Poland in 89 or East Germany in 1990 were not totalitarian countries. They were already much more democratic than some of the post-Soviet republics are now. It was a revolution which Professor Kubik, Jan Kubik, a Polish sociologist, called not a class revolution, but a moral revolution, a psychological revolution. It was not that the workers fought against bankers or corrupt officials and so on. It was people fought for honest elections, for human dignity, and for me, Ukrainians repeated what the East Germans did in Berlin in 19. In Leipzig, actually, I think, and Dresden. Wir sind das Volk. We are the people. We are not some cattle. We are not some goats. Therefore, we want to be recognized as a nation with all the rights for individual and group. And second, wir sind ein Volk, the Germans said, and so did Ukrainians. We are one people, namely whether it's Lviv or Odessa, whether you are Jewish or Russian. Some of the greatest Ukrainian heroes are called Gongadze. Now you know that Gongadze is not a typical Galician surname, but in other words, people with German, Jewish, Armenian could be Ukrainian citizens. And that's what I feel connects Ukraine to the cycle of the revolutions in Eastern Europe, in the Soviet bloc. Ukraine became this transition from there to East. Finally, my conclusion, first of all, is I already gave you is Moscow overlooked it all. In other words, consultants, PR people, advisors, with some notable exceptions, but people who made all these points for Mr. Putin, they did not notice civil society, they did not notice the significance of religion, they did not notice that you can be a Ukrainian nationalist speaking Russian. You know very well how many people in Kiev actually spoke in Russian during those demonstrations. People who were screaming, yelling, Poland, Poland, they were doing it not only in Ukrainian, but also in Russian. In other words, Moscow got that. It also, I think, did not understand the psychological factor of the revolution, namely that people took it as a personal insult, that the president who was being imposed of them is actually a former criminal, a former criminal. And I try to understand how stupid can you get, because they could have possibly gotten someone more plausible to, and Yushchenko did not have to win. I am a historian who believes that things can go various ways. Why did they choose someone who was so awful as a human being even? And my suspicion is, and this may express my, you know, anti-Russian yearnings or suspicions, but as I say, I always exclude good Russians from it. Remember, there are good Russians. I think they wanted to finish the process which Moscow assumed had started in 91. Namely, I said, they will follow Moscow, Ukrainians, you remember. What I did not say, but now will say, is they also assumed that the Soviet Empire will keep being restored. Integration. And Yanukovych became a spokesman for Ukraine's integration with Russia, the single economic space, and that was the strategy which is Putin's strategy. And by having a man like him to be Ukrainian president, you guaranteed that he will be a persona non grata everywhere beyond, in any place other than those Democratic Republic of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, or Tajikistan. In other words, they wanted to make, to complete the process of Ukraine's isolation from the outside world. Because even if Kuchma had trouble with getting invited to Bratislava, Yanukovych would not have been invited even, well, I cannot name which, to Liechtenstein. Okay. So we have here, therefore, a very interesting problem, and these are my conclusions, namely, where Russia will go now. And I want to end on a very positive note, namely, what was so remarkable about the fall of 2004 is how many Russians in Moscow issued declarations of support for Ukraine, how ethnic Russians in Ukraine supported that revolution too, and some of them, some brighter, better informed commentators were pointing out, look, Ukrainians are not sort of a copy of what Russia does. The name of the game in Ukraine, they are playing another play. They are acting in a different, Ukraine is not a play, replay local version of the Russian play. Они играют другую пьесу. Ukrainians are performing a different play. And I gave you some ideas about what this different play is about, because 1945 and various other dates, and if I had more time, I would have even mentioned 1848, but because of lack of time, I will not do so. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I will just say I will not represent Poland here because I think that the discussion needs to go on ahead. I just want to say one thing, disagree, because I want to disagree with the speakers on one thing, and that is this idea of how to define the nature of these revolutions that have been happening in these countries. And I think that there are two, for me, there are two very, very important characteristics of these revolutions. First of them is that these are revolutions for national independence. And I'm surprised that you did not mention it. Even in the case, I felt, maybe it's my mistake, even in the case of Ukraine, that really this revolution was, the Orange Revolution was a continuation of that. And when they say we are the people, what they mean, we are a nation. And we want independence. The second thing, very important for me, and I'm glad you mentioned all the 1945 and the Polish Ukrainian massacres. These revolutions are pan-European in their character, in that sense that Europe in my opinion, after 1945, became non-violent. To a certain degree, of course, but decided in some very profound way of avoiding violence if possible. And if you look at the characteristic of these revolutions, these are, after all, revolutions in the countries in which incredible violence has been committed, in which no city has its original population, and no borders are the same as they were in 1945, before 1945, and so on. All of them are incredibly peaceful and non-violent. We thought in 1980 with the Solidarity that this was because it was Polish revolution, and this is because it was a revolution which was supported by Catholic Church to a certain degree only, but to some part of the Catholic Church. But that proved that this was not an exception. It was really a rule, and all of them are the same. So this is the only thing that I wanted to say. And I thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a panel discussion sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences at Boston University. Speaking tonight was Lila Shevtsova, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Also speaking was Roman Shporluk, Mykhailo Krushevsky Professor of Ukrainian History at Harvard University. Tonight's discussion was titled The Orange Revolution, Ukraine and Russia in Today's World. We began with an introduction by Institute Executive Director and tonight's moderator, Irina Grudzinska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim